Creeping towards spring up in the northern hemisphere. Today we have another interesting program for you, the sacred veneration of the honeybee. From Sumeria to Egypt and Crete, they all understood the importance of the honeybee to their existence as a civilization. But there's so much more to it. Whole concepts and rituals has arisen around the bee, and some of this have been forgotten today. This is a topic that many in our modern scientific GMO world might not think about, but we did have that scare a few years back when a lot of bees around the world were dying, and that is something as well we'll address later in the program, together with Andrew Goff. He has been an enthusiast of the esoteric for decades. He's the editor-in-chief of Mindscape, an international magazine, chairman of the Wren Group, and former director of the Institute of Interdisciplinary Sciences, ISIS, or ISIS. Andrew has also been featured in several documentaries. Goff has written for journals and publication, and is considered an expert on bees and their mythology. He is currently finishing a new book called The Hidden Hive of History, The Forgotten God of the Ancients. Yep, the lost tradition and the veneration of the sacred bee, a topic, a subject matter that I've wanted to talk about for a long time now, and I don't think there's anyone better at the moment that we can discuss this with than Andrew Goff. Excellent to have you on the program. Welcome to Red Ice, Andrew. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
You bet. This is going to be really, really interesting. I don't think we can begin on the subject matter overall before we, you know, address some of the background, obviously, and then go into a little bit of some of the other people involved in this. I know as well that you've interviewed people like Simon Buxton, obviously. He's, I think, the first guy I heard about when it comes to this subject matter, and we can talk about him a little bit later as well. But your website, tell us a little bit about that first. When you kind of kicked things off, you moved over to the UK. Obviously, you're an American. Give us a little background, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you. I've been living in the UK for 15 years. I'm from Chicago. And, boy, it must have been about 6 or 7 years ago that I became quite poorly, and I couldn't work. I had something they call Bell's palsy. So if you had chicken pox as a kid, then you can get this Bell's palsy thing, which means a nerve in your face twitches and you look really horrible and you sound really horrible. So I had to take a month off while I had an acupuncturist to fix that, because my day job is sort of a business job, and I can't look, you know, too distorted.
But acupuncture took care of it. That's what you're saying.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Wow.
Amazing. While I was out of work, I mean, taking about 6 weeks off, I was asked to contribute to a mainstream book called Dan Brown Companion. So I wrote this huge, you know, sort of 40,000-50,000 words on the inspiration for Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Was actually the story, The Mystery of Rennes Le Chateau. And just to wind up the editors and the author a little bit, I put my name in there as somebody who figured it all out. But it was a joke, and I thought the editors would take it out, but they didn't. And in fact, they featured me as a prominent figure in the book. So they said, you've got to get a website. You have to go get a website because nobody knows who you are. So a little twist of fate prompted me to create a website. I've always been passionate about the esoteric, but it's only the last probably 7 years that I've had a website where I publish my own research on these subjects.
Excellent. And by the way, people can get there by simply typing in your name in a search engine, or straight up in the URL bar right there, Andrew Goff. And the last name, by the way, spelled G-O-U-G-H, and that's .com. And we're going to have this link up on the website, of course, but it's called Arcadia as well. Tell us just briefly about that term, if you will.
Yeah, Arcadia, I like the term because the concept is really sort of one of nirvana, of a golden age. And there have been many golden ages, but it was a time when all was really right with the world. And there's many eras and epochs where people have felt they were in a golden age. Certainly, we're not in one now, but it's nice in times like these to reflect back on when we were.
Excellent. Okay, well, when we begin to touch upon the topic here of the sacred tradition of the bee, I think we should just cover a little bit of ground first of Simon Buxton. By the way, we tried to get him on the program a while back. He was unable at the time, and we haven't been in contact with him since, actually. But he wrote, of course, The Shamanic Way of the Bee. Was this one of the first works that you stumbled into as well, or did you have another entry way into this, Andrew?
Well, you know, thank you for asking, because Simon's a good friend of mine, and I was just, I've been in touch with him the last couple of days. We're planning some projects together, and I attended his weekend course in London. He does these all over the world on shamanism just about a year and a half ago. Fabulous stuff, where you journey, and it's facilitated by Simon himself. So we have a lot of mutual respect, and he's actually been the impetus for me kind of writing all this research on the bee down. And I must say, I've done it entirely backwards. You would think Simon Buxton would be the first place where you would start, but it was actually one of my last. And how I did start, I mentioned this Rennes Le Château fascination of mine, and I'm chairman of the Ren Group, and really into that mystery. And so that allowed me to meet with Patrice Chaplin, who is an acclaimed author, and her books have been made into Hollywood films and things like that. And she lives here in London, so she wrote a couple books on Rennes Le Château that really changed that whole kind of mystery for a lot of people. So one of her kind of discoveries was that the priest Berenger Saunier was going to Girona, and she made some incredible claims about this. So I went to Girona to validate her research, and in the process, I stumbled across this Kabbalist who she writes about in the book, who's known as Ingrid. She's just passed away in the past year, and she taught Salvador Dali and Jean Cocteau, and I was fortunate enough to be asked by her to study with her. And when I went to see her the first time, I wanted to study about the Rennes Le Château parchments. And because they're really mysterious, no one really knows what they mean. So we were going to decompose them in the Kabbalah. But on the balcony, long-winded story, sorry, on the balcony as we're having breakfast before we, you know, get on with our 15-hour study day, right. And there were many of those, this huge bee flies around our breakfast table. And we got to talking about bees. And we researched bees for the next few years. And I never even Googled bees. I was just studying them in these ancient texts with this renowned Kabbalist. So that's kind of how I got started with it.
Excellent. When I first stumbled over this was hearing about Simon Buxton, of course, and his book Shamanic Way of the Bee. And as I understand it, too, he has two more books out since that time, Darkness Visible, and then I think his latest one there is called The Serpent Flight of the Honeybee. I haven't read those two, but fascinating stuff. And lead someone, you know, someone is new to this topic. Can you just lead us into it? What is it about the honeybee that is so special, Andrew?
Well, thank you. And first of all, I would recommend everyone read Simon's book. It's written, he's got such a lovely writing style, and he makes a very esoteric, spiritual, and complex subject really easy to get. So The Shamanic Way of the Bee, fabulous. And if people like that and like what they hear tonight about the bee, then I would recommend Simon's Sacred Trust in the UK, which is a holistic sort of center for spiritual awakening in traditions of the sacred bee. So what is a sacred bee? I mean, everyone's talking about the fact that the bees are dying, and you know, we can come on to that. I don't think there's a mystery as to why they're dying, although I do think there's a conspiracy. But the thing about the bee is that it's the single greatest lost tradition, full stop. Nothing else is as airbrushed from history as what this little creature used to mean. So where does one start? I mean, Egypt. Take Egypt, for instance. So the pharaoh's title was beekeeper. The area around the delta from the Mediterranean to Cairo was called Tabiti, the land of the bee. There was a picture of a bee in the pharaoh's cartouche, and all the ingredients of the bees were really vital to that society. And thus what we see, and I think this happens a lot, is something that's really basic becomes deified. Something that's really important to survival, but maybe not mysterious in its own right, becomes deified. So honey, it's medicinal, ritualistic uses for mummification, for use in beer, and beer was a form of commerce. The stinger itself was used for acupuncture. All kinds of different byproducts to pollinate. I mean, today China is introducing humans to try to employ more humans and, you know, more power to them. 26 humans to do the job of a bee. To pollinate.
Of one bee?
One bee. Wow. So it's nuts. So ancient civilizations and modern ones who recognize the value of the bee and its byproducts have flourished. Those who haven't have perished, which is why Albert Einstein is alleged, he's never written it down, but he's alleged to have said that if the bees die, man has 4 years left. And that the bees started to die in 2008, so that takes us right up to
here we are,
the infamous 2012.
Yeah, that's right. I want to get your take on this. I want to hear what you have to say about what currently is happening and the conspiracy that you mentioned before. For a moment, though, let's go back a little bit more in history here, into prehistory, if you will. We hear often about bear cults and lots of tribes around the world and in definitely parts of Europe were venerating the bear. But what about the bee then? What are some of the clues that we can find in history for bee worship, if we go back, Andrew?
Well, again, the bee was, you know, bees have been found 100 million years old, petrified, preserved in amber, as though immortalized in their own honey. And that very special visual effect made them more interesting than other creatures from a very, very long time ago. And what we see on the walls of tombs and temples in Egypt, but even before that, 15,000 years ago, we're seeing pictures, for instance, in Spain, in Valencia, in the Cave of the Spider. They have a man risking life and limb to gather honey because there's so many things you can do with honey. It's so important to your civilization, to your ability to thrive as a community. So man has always, from a hunter-gatherer perspective, always been really, really focused on the honey. But I'm making it sound pretty mundane. It really is incredibly mystical. And the Sumerians are a good example. They have more cultural first than any other civilization, right? They were the first to really introduce the bee and all its byproducts to all of their society. And people like Zakhara Sitchin, for instance, who I spoke to before he died last year, famous researcher who has his own interpretations of the Sumerian stela and text, which have, you know, extraterrestrial kind of implications in his estimation. Right. And I'm open to all that, but you look at these stela of the Sumerians, and they show weird kind of flying creatures being deified. And he would tell you that those are extraterrestrials. I would tell you those are bees. And one of the reasons why people think, oh, come on, they can't be bees. Well, there's a great amount of evidence that ancient man knew that the bee was the only living creature that communicated by dance. And so, I mean, Aristotle, Plato's writing about it. We know that in Egypt, all these figures these dancing goddesses, they're really inspired by the bee. And I know that sounds nuts, but in Egypt, you have really the founding goddess of Egypt is the goddess Neith, N-E-I-T-H, and she lives in Sais, which is in the sort of western delta, northwest of Cairo. Mm-hmm. She lives in something called the House of the Bee. In her back garden is where Osiris is buried. And Osiris is buried in a place called the Mansion of the Bee. And the goddess Neith is venerated in Egypt almost before any other god or goddess. And I've spent a lot of time researching the Eastern Egyptian desert, which goes from Luxor east to the Red Sea and the Wadi Hammamat. And this is where arguably the original founders of the Nile Valley came into Egypt. And you've got these incredible boat carvings, these petroglyphs in the now dried up riverbeds or wadis. Mm. And they all show this kind of interesting altar in the middle of the boat. And they all show, a lot of them show, I should say, this funny round, like a oblong basketball, up in the front of the ship, elevated. Well, part of my research has led me to conclude that that altar in the middle of the boat is a portable beehive. These are the survivors of the flood, the biblical flood, coming into Egypt, and they're using bees to help identify where the land is. Hmm. And this is the goddess Neith who's coming in to the Nile Valley, and everything's underwater. The world's just been inundated with a series of floods. And so Egypt is just builds up around the notion of the sacredness of the bee, and hence it's named after it.
What do you think all of this has to do with the roots of agriculture then? It must be, obviously we understand that the two are joined here because so much of our own food supply, of course, as you alluded to earlier, that quote from Einstein about the fact that our whole food supply would collapse if the bee, you know, disappeared. So the discovery, if there is such a thing, or development rather, of agriculture, do you think that that was known by the early Sumerians? This could be, sure, arguably there's other cultures around the world that are competitors, if you will, to what the Sumerians achieved, and this could certainly have happened in other continents of the world at the same time, but their knowledge of this, is that why you think they put so much emphasis on the bee? And as I need to detail on your website as well, you even have the interpretation of actually, if you look at some of the Sumerian depictions, if you will, of the Anunnaki, if that's what actually is on there, they're depicted with wings, as you say, and you can see, if you want to see it, you can see that this might be a bee, right?
Yeah, and I mean, so the whole thing, again, it's fascinating because I argue elsewhere that the ink, you know, people have all these mystical ideas about symbols, and I believe in applying Occam's razor to all this stuff. So what's the simplest explanation for this? It might be something really fantastic, but let's eliminate the simple explanations first before we start looking at really wild stuff. And I think oftentimes things that were really fundamental became extremely invaluable and thus esoteric. So, for instance, the ink. One of the definitions of the ink is the key to the Nile, and the ink looks just like an anchor. Linguistically, there's some similarities. And, you know, you couldn't have a culture without the ability to ground yourself in a river for commerce, for battle, for all those sorts of things. And I think the bee is another example of that. But it's also really mystical because we're talking about Egypt. I'm talking about this notion of the biblical flood and survivors of it coming in from Mesopotamia into Egypt. And that whole eastern desert, the god associated with that is the god Min, M-I-N. He's the master of the wild bees. he may have even been the first king to unify the North and the South. But it goes back even earlier. So, for example, you mentioned this whole religion, the Sumerian thing. In Çatalhöyük in Turkey, there is, God, there's so much. First of all, there's a huge temple wall that has a beehive etched onto it. So, you know, picture, you know, 10 meters long, very high wall of a beehive. And, you know, why would you have a beehive in your religious ritual center where you have these big sculptures of bulls? And we'll see in a moment that bulls and bees are intrinsically related.
That's right. But
also, Çatalhöyük, you have the first ever halo. And the halo is a hunter, sort of shamanically in motion, with a halo around his head made up of bees. And so very possibly the first halo, because so much came from Turkey, the bull leaping images, all these things kind of start in Turkey. And as we'll see, religion is very intrinsically tied to the bee. I mean, go to Rome today, to Vatican City, look at the statues of the popes. They had beehives on their head, just like Osiris had. Osiris had a beehive on his head. And the Essenes were known as the king bees. Jesus was known as the ethereal bee. John the Baptist survived on honey in the desert, and the crop circle in 2004 appears in Wiltshire on his feast day of a bee. So you have all these weird synchronicities.
So the symbolism, again, from the ancient world has it right there, and it seems to be, it has been somewhat overlooked, I guess, in one sense. If we look at the Çatalhöyük there, the beehive comb symbolism that's right there on the wall, this is another feature, of course, that is related even to sacred geometry, right? We have this hexagonal pattern of the beehive comb. What is that all about, and why do you think that if it has been left out of history, why is that, do you think?
Well, it's a very good question. Some of the symbolism has been reserved for those who are in special positions to understand, and other aspects of it have just been forgotten. So, for instance, two examples. One is the fleur-de-lis in Napoleon's era. Everyone regards that as a lily, so, you know, a fleur-de-lis. But in Napoleon's era, all the philosophers and doctors and thinkers knew that that was a stylized bee. And when you see the picture in front of you as the bee morphs to a fleur-de-lis, it makes a lot of sense. And what was Napoleon's nickname, the bee? What's he celebrating? He's celebrating his heritage, a Merovingian long-haired kings, one of which was Childeric, who had 300 gold bees buried in his tomb. And France itself is shaped in such a way that if you draw a lines around it, it forms a hexagon. And they know that. And they were and are really proud of that. And in a beehive, the hexagon shape only happens at a real, I think it's 45 Celsius, really high temperature. It goes from being round into that magical shape, which occurs all throughout nature.
I've seen that. Just comment quickly on that. You know, the transition, if you will, between the bee over to the fleur-de-lis. I think the first time I saw that was in Manly Palmer Hall's book, Sacred Teachings of All Ages.
That's right. That's
fascinating. That nails it right there. And I've had a totally different relationship to the fleur-de-lis ever since, actually, I saw that.
Well, and you know, and another example, and I wish I could take credit for both of these, but they're not. They're obscure pieces of research, one you just referenced. Another one comes from 1958, and it's brilliant. And that is the double axe. the double axe we see in Kettle Hewick for the first time. We see it in Stonehenge. But we see it all over Minoan Crete. So, you know, we all know what an axe is, right? So this is an axe going both directions. Mm. Scholars have noted that the double axe from Kettle Hewick artistically resembles a butterfly. That's interesting. Because in Minoan Crete, gosh, go and look at any of the classic frescoes, and you see double axes. They're fair, and this, you know, that's a weapon, right? That's a weapon. And we're told it's used to ritualistically kill the bulls. Well, they're depicted in a very feminine way, and they look like they're suckling flowers, and they look just like a bee. And what's interesting is that the goddess of Crete, Rhea, the goddess of all gods, and the goddess of Turkey, Sibyl, are both the goddess of the axe and the greatest sort of city in Minoan, the Mediterranean, is Knossos, and it's the palace of the double axe.
Hmm.
And I argue that it's the palace of the bee, because the double axe is the bee. But it's like you asked a little earlier, is how come this is not more overt? And that's a big part of the debate. It's almost something that's so sacred that it just needs to be sort of inferred.
Does it indicate that it's a secretive cult in one sense, that the knowledge of the bee? I mean, obviously, as we've already detailed here, hints throughout history, hints in certain nations, the Napoleonic era, nonetheless. How, if this tradition is carried, it's there in history in a very subtle way, but the knowledge from the point of view of those who hold the knowledge of the veneration of the bee don't seem too happy to share it with everybody, if I put it that way, right?
Well, but in Egypt, again, the land of the bee, the pharaoh is the beekeeper. There's a bee in the pharaoh's cartouche. Hatshepsut looked upon her people in Egypt as bee people. That's what she called them. And you know, bees were on the boats, I argue, that came into the Nile Valley. And that original goddess who was on that boat is remembered as a bee goddess, because she came in, and when she arrived, things got better. And we're talking about Turkey. I mean, it goes back so far. We're talking about a flood, right? Floods all around the world. What would cause a flood? I mean, what would cause all of the earth to flood? Because there's a lot of floodness around that time. And I don't claim to have the answer to all this, but one thing that would cause that is if we were pelted with meteorites.
Right.
And so I'm writing all this in a book which is coming out later this year called The Hidden Hive of History.
Mm, that's right.
And at the moment, the book opens with the fact that Rome, in about, 200 BC, gets pelted with meteorites. And it freaks everyone out, understandably.
Right.
150 years later, the meteorites come back, and people get freaked out again. So the government, the Senate, says, we're going to consult something called the Sibylline Text. And the Sibylline Text are actually oracle utterances written by a bee goddess, a high priestess who's regarded as a bee goddess, because the bee goddess and the mother goddess are kind of one and the same in this era. And what do these utterances say? to save Rome from the bad omens that these meteorites appear to represent, because they're losing a war at the time, they have to go and get the mother goddess from Turkey.
Hmm.
And guess what the mother goddess is? The mother goddess is called Sibyl, and Sibyl is a meteorite. And Sybil's regarded as a bee goddess, just like Rhea is on Crete. So they go and they go to Turkey and they pick up this meteorite. And it begs the question, why is a meteorite regarded as sacred? Well, we all know that things that came from the heavens, i.e. meteorites, were regarded as gifts from the gods. But what did these people remember that these are the things that caused their world to be turned on its head, that caused the flood? But in any case, Rome actually has this big procession of the meteorite, Sybil, the bee goddess, the mother goddess, from Turkey into Rome, and it's accompanied by her priest. So the meteorite has its own priesthood, and the priesthood dresses in yellow and castrates themselves. And that's very, in my opinion, much an ode to the drone bee who has sex with the queen and then dies. And so there was just a wave of castration cults in Rome. And the Senate, they were freaking out. So they had to ban castration. And where has that black stone, where has that mother goddess, bee goddess, the original mother goddess, gone? Well, there's another black stone. They put it in a temple in Mecca. And guess what the priest in the mosque in Mecca do? Castrate themselves.
They do, huh?
So I'm not saying it's the same stone. Could be. But that tradition is interesting. And when I was studying with that Kabbalist, we determined that in the Kabbalah, the numeric value of meteorite, if you put a number for each letter, right, is a 443, which is the same value as the word B in Egyptian.
This is the Hebrew Kabbalah, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, again, the whole concept of numerology of applying numeric values to letters.
Because there's a Greek gematria, and there's a few different ones, so I just want to clarify that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It really is, in that period, it's very, very mystical. And continues to be mystical. The golden age of the bee veneration was ancient Egypt and ancient Crete. And
then the Romans begin to freak out because of the consequence of all of this.
Yeah, and so they built a temple for the meteorite, and they put it on Palatine Hill, and it sort of disappears a few hundred years later. Nobody knows where it's gone. And what I think is really interesting is that the place in Egypt, Sais, where we talked about the goddess Neith had her temple of the bee, and Osiris is buried in the mansion of the bee, and Osiris had a symbol of a beehive on his head. And, of course, the plumes of the pharaoh, I argue, are inspired by bees. Those plumes are first seen in the sort of in the Kata II period, and that's all from the boats that are coming into the Nile Valley, and those, the rock art surrounding those now barren rivers, those wadis, all has these tall plumes. The god of the region is called the master of the wild bees. And look at, the best example is to look at the death mask of Tutankhamun, or any pharaoh. It's yellow and black horizontal stripes.
That's right, yeah.
The bee, why wouldn't it be the bee? His title was beekeeper. He reigned in the land of the bee. But nobody ever talks about that. No Egyptology books ever mention it.
Well, I love, by the way, Andrew, sorry to interrupt, but I got to bring that up too, the modern little honey dipper, and you compare it to the jed pillar. Tell us about that one. That's fascinating.
Yeah, so again, this notion that the most esoteric and magically charged symbols may have had original functionality that was quite mundane. The anchor could have turned into the ink, for example, was one we gave earlier. Mm-hmm. But you have this this symbol that's always being put up to the pharaoh's mouth. It's used in the rituals of regeneration, and the pharaoh's sort of the Jed pillar is. It's used in the Sed festivals where the pharaoh celebrates the renewal of his next term, if you will. And again, this weird sort of vertical bar or pole with circles around the top. People have speculated that it is like the backbone of the bull, or it is the tree of life. When you don't know what a symbol is, just say it's a tree of life. Everyone will but when you net it down, this is the pharaoh, whose title is beekeeper, has a bee in his cartouche, no other creature. He has an office in his administration of the keeper of the honey, and lives in the land of the bee. So he of the sedge and the bee is what his title is. So I believe it could be a symbolic honey dripper. A honey dripper looks just like a Jed pillar, and when the Greeks start getting into all this sort of bee veneration, the centurions, the chaps who lived to be 100 years old, when asked, how did you live to be 100? They all say, honey. Egypt kind of passes it on to Crete. And therein, I think, lies one of the most fascinating elements of the bee veneration, and it has to do with Atlantis.
How so? Tell us about that.
So, I keep mentioning Sais. I'm kind of obsessed about Sais because it's just sort of bee veneration central there in the Delta and in Egypt.
Yeah.
And it's completely dismantled. There's nothing there now. But ironically, one of the things that was there was the Rosetta Stone. And the Rosetta Stone was moved to Rosetta from Sais, but
wait a minute. That's an interesting point there, because how was it found there originally if there was nothing around at the time?
Well, Sais has a long history because originally it was a place where the kings of Egypt were based, and later on, very very late period, it also became the central point, the kingdom of the rulers of Egypt. But it faded really, really quickly. I mean, there's nothing left. But what Sais is most well known for is not the fact that there's a temple of the bee and the mansion of the bee and the greatest goddess in Egypt, who is the bee goddess, lived there, and Osiris is buried in the bee man. Nobody cares about that. They care about Sais because that's where the legend of Atlantis comes from. So the Greek lawgiver Solon goes to Sais, and the priests there tell him all about this lost civilization of Atlantis. And he goes back, tells it to his mates. Plato hears about it. Plato writes about it. And that's the only account we have. And it's such a fantastic story that 300 years after Solon, this guy called Crantor, a philosopher, says, I don't believe it. I'm going to go check it out. And he does, and they tell him the same thing. In fact, the story of Atlantis is written on the pillars of this now gone temple, which is why I think it's interesting that Egyptologists have identified that bits of it were dismantled and moved, and one of those was the Rosetta Stone. So the thing that gives us sight into hieroglyphics, ironically, comes from the place where only place that talks about Atlantis. Here's why that's interesting is, have you been to Egypt?
No, actually, I have not yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, anyone listening who's been will know that when you go to a temple, it's really high testosterone stuff. It's images of Pharaoh smiting his enemy and dragging the poor bugger by the hair to prison. Really macho stuff. So you would never, I couldn't imagine an Egyptian temple venerating some other culture. I don't care how old it is. And that's always bothered me. And the thing that you struggle with Atlantis is that these priests in Sais, the city of the bee, tell Solon that Atlantis was 9,000 years before that time. But there appears to be evidence that these priests were talking lunar years. So a month is a year.
But what is that, 9,000 months then, or 6,000? What is it?
So 9,000 years divided by 30 puts you right smack at 1100-ish BC. And that is the exact time that we now know the three successive earthquakes of Thera happened. And the Minoans and the Greeks were contemporary. The Egyptians were contemporaries. Mm-hmm. They were allies. So to me, it makes much more sense that the story of Atlantis refers to Minoan Crete. Because if you look at a map of Crete, and you go directly north of Crete, 60 kilometers, you run into Thera. And Atlantis, and there's still another obstacle to arguing successfully that Atlantis was Crete, although it's the best scientific, historical, geographic argument, I feel, and that is the Pillars of Hercules, which is, you know, Spain and Africa, Gibraltar.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a problem. But I argue in my book what could in effect be the answer to that. And without giving too much away, it has to do with Crete. And when you look at Crete, wow, it has all the ingredients that we're told Atlantis had. It venerated bees. We talked about the double axe and the temple of the bee, or the temple, the palace of the bee, which is known as Knossos, the palace of the double axe. But the word for labyrinth, which Atlantis is always associated with a labyrinth, labyrinth, L-A-B-R-Y-S, I think it is the word for double axe. And a labyrinth looks an awful lot like a natural honeycomb. And in case you think I'm really losing the plot here, it gets weirder because Crete is obsessed about growing poppies. Poppies are what you use to create opium and heroin. And if you look at the Minoans made little miniatures of their boats, and these boats, and little ceramic, and they have them in museums. You can look at them. And what do they have in the boats? Beehives. And all the honey in the Aegean, so the area, you know, around the Med, is hallucinogenic. And I argue the Minoans were the drug lords of the Aegean. You mix opium and heroin with hallucinogenic honey, and you take that around the Med. It's the kind of honey that makes you go blind. So at Delphi, which is in of course, in Greece, it was built by the bees, according to mythology, and there's a bee priestess, and there's an oracle stone, the most famous oracle stone in all the world, and look at it, it looks like a beehive, and there's bees on it. I'm not making it up. You couldn't make it up. And if you go there today, and they actually destroy all the wild honeycombs. They won't let them be harvested because they're wildly hallucinogenic. And if you look at all the seals, these, you know, in Crete, you had these tiny little, you know, 1-inch long kind of signets and seals, and there's real intricate images on there, and people have no idea what those images are. Well, in 1958, they showed those images to beekeepers. And the beekeeper said, oh, right, okay, well, that woman's bending the branches of the tree down, and she's getting honey, and that's a hive, and guess what? There's a boat. And in the boat, that's a beehive. I know that because in ancient times, that's how the beehives were shaped. It's a portable one for transporting up and down a river, because that's what you do when you're harvesting bees, is you're always moving them to where the flowers are.
Right.
And so there is all this. But now, once you see it, it's like, oh my gosh, the ancient world was obsessed about honey. And so I think that the legend of the labyrinth, I don't think there was a labyrinth. This mystical labyrinth. No, I think it had to do with the production of hallucinogenic drugs out of Knossos that were being marketed across the Mediterranean.
How about that? So are you saying, I want to go, touch a little bit more on Crete here, but are you saying as well that the tradition has been lost and then rediscovered since, for this example that you just brought up, that beekeepers modern today, when they look at some of this stuff, say, oh, okay, that's what they show, basically. It implies we've lost the knowledge, correct?
Yeah, and it's something that I have been trying, and I must say failing, to come up with a good modern analogy, but it's something that just so apparent that it doesn't need to be said. And it's really peculiar. That we've forgotten it. I'm looking at, I have the advantage of looking at some images from Crete in front of me, and there's a few giveaways. When you see a goddess in a skirt that has seven tears, the snake goddess from Crete, she has snakes in both hands.
That's right. Yeah,
she has a seven-tier dress, and originally that dress was alternating yellow and black, and I probably won't be able to extract this off the top of my head, but the snakes, there was a, gosh, I wish I can think of it. There was a word that had to do with the froth that comes out of their mouth. And it had to do with, a drug that you would take for this shamanic experience. So here you have these goddesses wearing these seven-tier dresses. And it's not just me who's making these wild conclusions. People like Marjorie Gumbutas and others have shown that these dancing figures with their arms up and over their head, almost always in a skirt that's horizontally striped, are in fact bee goddesses. And I'm pausing because it gets even stranger. This notion of the arms up over the head. That's really ancient. It's really ancient. In shamanic world, the horns of an animal are great protection. And you always see dancing goddesses with their arms up in the air. And in Knossos, one of the greatest, you know, centers of ancient civilization, they have what they call the horns of consecration. So if you were to take your index finger and your little finger and put them out and keep all the rest of your fingers down, that's called the sign of the horn.
Right.
And it's the most ancient symbol for warding off the evil eye. So, if you were here now and I gave you the evil eye, and I was a bad man, I'd want to curse you and your family and all your descendants. Forgive me, you know, something like that. and the evil eye. So you didn't want, in Greece, they used to harvest honey at night because they were afraid of the evil eye, and the evil eye would ruin their harvest of the honey. The honey was so important because you're putting it in your drugs, which are used in your rituals. You're putting it in your drinks, which are used in commerce. And you're doing mummification. You're doing everything with the byproducts of this little creature. So kenosis is covered with horns of consecration. And the famous one are these two big horns. And everyone talks about, oh, they're bull horns. I'm not convinced. I think they are the most ancient symbol to ward off the evil eye. And in my presentation, when I go around England, the very graphical presentation talking about this, the sign of the horn. Everyone listening, make it with me now. Put your fist out. Make a fist and put up your index finger and your little finger. And that sign is the sign used by the Pope, by politicians. Politicians in particular all use it. And certain rock stars use it.
And people, by the way, Andrew says that these are it's evidence they're part of the Illuminati and that they're satanic. That's what
you're doing. Yes. But that's the symbol that was used to ward off the evil eye. And you see that symbol all over. Yeah, it's all over Crete, it's all over kenosis, and I believe it's tied to the belief that we need to protect the harvest of the most critical element in our.
So is it? I mean, it's a tradition, obviously, and I'm always curious to know how intentional and how aware people who are making these things truly are. But when it comes to this, the hand signal that we talked about. But in comparison then to the evil eye, just briefly just tell us about that, what that is then, and what do you think that the ancient people thought that was?
Well, they thought that gods or other empowered, skilled individuals, i.e. priests, could curse you. So evil eye was a curse. And hence, again, the example in Greece, honey harvesting was done at night so that evil eyes couldn't impact the productive harvest of the honey. And you have this great center of kenosis, which is just full of horns of consecration, which is the same shape as the sign of the horn we just did.
Mm. Yeah, bull symbolism overall. I mean, that's the homeland of Crete, you know?
Yeah, but that, that is, it means something else. And like all great symbols, the Ankh, the Jed pillar, they have multiple meanings.
Yes.
Which makes them really, really special. So we haven't touched on the bull, and that's one of the weirdest bits of the whole thing.
Andrew, why don't we hold off on that to the second segment, though, because I want to squeeze in a little bit of info here, obviously, about your book, how the progress is going, when you suspect it might be out, and then if there's anything else you want to mention, both pertaining to your website, want to give out the URL again, but also maybe future speaking engagements. Where can people see you next, for instance?
Thank you. I'm speaking in the UK in March, April, and May. I have presentations at Hugh Newman's Megalithomania in Glastonbury and at Lucy Watts' conference in Sussex. And I'll put all these on my website so you can come and see me if you like. And I'm going to hopefully be presenting in London. I present all over the country except for London for some reason. on June 30th, we're going to have a very special visitor from the U.S., a PhD, who I just have a lot of respect for, and she's written a couple books on the lost sort of tradition of sacred women being able to procreate without a partner, virgin birth. And that's what bees do. That's what butterflies do. Hence, the double axe appears as both of those. So it's all kind of tied together. And so we're thinking of doing another conference in in June, and I'm talking to Simon about a really big conference, but he's away that week, so that's why I've been talking to him the last couple of days. And Simon's such a lovely guy. His advice to me is, I'll participate, Andy, but it's not just about the lectures. We have to do the rituals. We have to do the dancing and the singing and some other things that come along with bee veneration. The whole subculture, shamanically, across Europe in particular, of Melissas, of bee goddesses, of people who are dead serious about the shamanistic element of bee veneration. And that's what Simon Buxton writes so effectively about in his book, The Shamanic Way of Bee.
That's right. The website, by the way, I want to give that out for Simon's work and some of the other people he's working with there as well. Sacredtrust.org will get you more information and info about their talks and workshops and what have you there. So
fantastic.
And then, of course, Andrew, we have your website, andrewgauth.com, last name GOUGH.com. We will have this link up on redascreations.com as well. And briefly now, before we end for the first segment, tell us about your magazine as well, Mindscape Magazine.
Yeah, I'm editor-in-chief of Mindscape Magazine, and that has been an international print magazine, and we're kind of honing that into mostly print in the UK, but you can buy it in stores across Europe, and I know you can buy it in stores in Sweden.
There we
and
go.
It's all about mind, mystery, and ancient history, and we have some fantastic writers. We have Robert Eisenman of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we have Gary Osborne, who's just publishing an amazing new book, and I'm going to forget all sorts of people. Madeline Namro. We have Anthony Peake on consciousness. Fantastic, fantastic stuff there. But more than anything, I'm trying to get entirely new voices. I meet people on the bus, and we'll have a conversation about this or that, and I'll be fascinated, and I'll say, write me something on that. Give me an article. And they do. So we have all kinds of fresh new voices. And the issue that's out right now is a special edition on 2012.
It's the hot topic of the year, obviously. Can't avoid
it. Yes. And I went out to all sorts of people. There's 27 different authors, 75,000 plus words in this special edition with all kinds of different viewpoints on 2012. And it's one of my favorite subjects, although you may not want to get me started on that one.
We'll see how far towards that subject we can get in our next hour, because there's obviously so much more just about the bee tradition that I want to discuss with you more in the next segment here. So we'll continue our fascinating discussion. Stay with us, Andrew. We'll be right back with more after a short break here.
Yeah.
In the second hour, we continue to discuss the symbolism of black and yellow. Egyptians and other ancient civilizations venerated the bee, as well as secret societies such as the Freemasons. Is an evil tradition connected to the bee? The queen bee and her worker drones reminds us of the detrimental collectivist structure of a socialist dictatorship, but there's other very strange aspects to all of this as well. Our conversation continues with etymological connections to bee. We discuss the Jed pillar, bull and bear symbolism. Also, many users of hallucinogenic compounds and other drugs have claimed that during their buzz, they feel a connection to insects and bees. Goff also shares his opinion on why the honeybees have been dying off in large numbers during the last few years. Finally, Andrew talks about the quantum components within the honeybee and their communication. This brings us into vibration, acoustics, and architecture. Architecture that is based on the beehive. One famous example of this is the Nazis' SS castle in Wevelsburg in Paderborn, Germany, that produces a phenomenal resonance. Much more coming up with Andrew Goff in Hour 2. Don't miss it. When you want to hear more, log into our member section and stream or download this or any of our previous programs. We go all the way back to 2006, and we have a lot of gems in the archive that awaits your inquisitive mind. Brain food, aspects, research, and perspectives that will help you to see things in a new light and hopefully help you to expand your reality tunnel. RedIceCreations.com, that's our website. Go there if you want to subscribe. All the details are on the web. Much more coming your way. Stay tuned to Red Ice Radio. We have Anthony Peake, Sonia Barrett, Carl Munk, Barbara Hand Clow, Stephen Bassett, Dean Clifford, Håkan Blomqvist, Gerard Williams, Maria Kvilhaug, Paul Levy, Laird Scranton, Robert Chalk, Louise Turi, and also J.J. Hertek with Desiree Hertek. That'll be an interesting program. But right now, more with Andrew Goff. Talk to you after the break.